Turn this morning to the book of Genesis and chapter 5. Genesis and chapter 5. Let's hear the word of God. This is the book of the genealogy of Adam. In the day that God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. He created them male and female and blessed them and called them mankind in the day they were created. And Adam lived 130 years and begot a son in his own image after his likeness and named him Seth. After he begot Seth, the days of Adam were 800 years, and he had sons and daughters. So all the days that Adam lived were 930 years, and he died. Seth lived 105 years and begot Enosh. After he begot Enosh, Seth lived 807 years and had sons and daughters. So all the days of Seth were 912 years, and he died. Enosh lived 90 years and begot Cainan. After he begot Cainan, Enosh lived 815 years and had sons and daughters. So all the days of Enosh were 905 years, and he died. Cainan lived 70 years and begot Mahalalel. After he begot Mahalalel, Cainan lived 840 years and had sons and daughters. So all the days of Cainan were 910 years, and he died. Mahalalel lived 65 years and begot Jared. After he begot Jared, Mahalalel lived 830 years and had sons and daughters. So all the days of Mahalalel were 895 years, and he died. Jared lived 162 years and begot Enoch. After he begot Enoch, Jared lived 800 years and had sons and daughters. So all the days of Jared were 962 years, and he died. Enoch lived 65 years and begot Methuselah. After he begot Methuselah, Enoch walked with God 300 years and had sons and daughters. So all the days of Enoch were 365 years. And Enoch walked with God and was not, for God took him. Methuselah lived 187 years and begot Lamech. After he begot Lamech, Methuselah lived 782 years and had sons and daughters. So all the days of Methuselah were 969 years, and he died. Lamech lived 182 years and had a son. And he called his name Noah, saying, "This one will comfort us concerning our work and the toil of our hands, because of the ground which the Lord has cursed." After he begot Noah, Lamech lived 595 years and had sons and daughters. So all the days of Lamech were 777 years, and he died. And Noah was 500 years old, and Noah begat Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Amen. May the Lord bless the reading of his word. Should we turn again to the scriptures and to the Gospel of Matthew and chapter 1? Matthew's Gospel, chapter 1. And we'll read the opening passage. The book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham begot Isaac. Isaac begot Jacob, and Jacob begot Judah and his brothers. Judah begot Perez and Zerah by Tamar. Perez begot Hezron, and Hezron begot Ram. Ram begot Amminadab. Amminadab begot Nashon, and Nashon begot Salmon. Salmon begot Boaz by Rahab. Boaz begot Obed by Ruth. Obed begot Jesse, and Jesse begot David the king. David the king begot Solomon by her who had been the wife of Uriah. Solomon begot Rehoboam, and Rehoboam begot Abijah, and Abijah begot Asa, and Asa begot Jehoshaphat, and Jehoshaphat begot Joram, and Joram begot Uzziah. Uzziah begot Jotham, and Jotham begot Ahaz, and Ahaz begot Hezekiah. And Hezekiah begot Manasseh, and Manasseh begot Ammon, and Ammon begot Josiah. Josiah begot Jeconiah and his brothers about the time they were carried away to Babylon. And after they were brought to Babylon, Jeconiah begot Shealtiel, and Shealtiel begot Zerubbabel. And Zerubbabel begot Abiud, and Abiud begot Eliakim, and Eliakim begot Azor, and Azor begot Zadok, and Zadok begot Achim, and Achim begot Eliad. Eliad begot Eleazar, Eleazar begot Matthan, and Matthan begot Jacob. And Jacob begot Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom was born Jesus, who is called Christ. So all the generations from Abraham to David are 14 generations. From David until the captivity in Babylon are 14 generations. And from the captivity in Babylon until Christ are 14 generations. Genealogies and family trees can have items of real interest in them. The BBC has for a long time now been airing a series following various celebrities as they've researched their family tree, and some have uncovered some very interesting and detailed stories. But on the whole, most family histories are pretty mundane things, aren't they? They're just a list of names and sometimes occupations, and usually it's not long before interest begins to wane, because after a while you're just reading a long list of names and it all begins to get a bit tedious. So the question naturally arises, why? Why does Matthew begin his gospel with a genealogy? Why this list of the ancestors of Jesus? We might assume that he wants people to read his gospel, and he wants people to be convinced by what he says. So why bore them stiff at the start of the book? I mean, just look at verse 13. Zerubbabel begot Abiud, and Abiud begot Eliakim, and Eliakim begot Azor, and Azor begot Zadok, and Zadok begot Achim, and Achim begot Eliud, and Eliud begot Eleazar, and on it goes. Does that excite you? Does it make you think, oh, I've really got to read more? So why does Matthew do this then? Why the family tree? You take a look at verses 1 to 17 and you think, I think I'll start at verse 18. Why is it here? Well, let's start with the assumption that Matthew is at least as intelligent as we are. And let's ask if he might have a reason for making us read through this family tree at the beginning of his gospel. Now, we probably won't uncover all his reasons for writing this, but I think we can see some here. And the first reason for this family tree is to stir up within us hope, God's hope. The very first verse, the book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. That's itself not just part of the family tree, rather it's the title for the book of Matthew. It introduces the family tree, but it's the title for the entire gospel of Matthew, the book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. And that phrase is picking up on a phrase that repeatedly appears in the book of Genesis, where several times you find the words, these are the generations of so-and-so. You find the phrase 10 times as you read through the book of Genesis, and it's one of the ways in which the author of the book divides up the material in the book of Genesis. But in only one instance do we find the exact heading that we have here in Matthew chapter 1. In Genesis chapter 5 that we read earlier, the book of the genealogy of Adam. And it's interesting that Matthew should begin his gospel in the same way. The book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ. And the Jews reading that, and if you were familiar with the Old Testament, more familiar, the Jews would say, oh, there's a direct parallel here. This is just like Genesis 5. That's how Genesis 5 starts. It comes after the account of Adam's fall into sin and so on, and the writer talks about a new beginning that starts with Adam. And he talks about how Adam fathered Seth, and Seth fathered Enosh, and on the story goes, as we read a short while ago. But in that new beginning with Adam, we notice that something invades the history. It's repeated again and again as you go through the genealogy. At the end of every entry, except one, we have the phrase, "And he died." The wages of sin. That's the book of the genealogy. That's the history of Adam. And that's the way that Genesis goes. It begins with creation. And you get to the end of the book of Genesis. And in chapter 50, what do you have? A coffin. Joseph's coffin in Egypt. It begins with Adam and it ends with the same refrain that you find in Genesis 5. And he died. And he died. But now it's Matthew talking here, and he says, I've got another story. And alongside Genesis 5, as it were, he says, this is the genealogy of Jesus Christ. Here's a new beginning. And this book and this history doesn't end in the same way that Adam's history and genealogy ends, because Matthew makes a new beginning that brings us to a different ending altogether. And you know how Matthew's history ends in chapter 28. It begins with Jesus Christ, his birth, his coming. It ends with an empty tomb. And that's why you've got this introduction here. Matthew's intention is to stir up within you a sense of hope. A new story is beginning, and it doesn't end with, "And he died." Here is hope for us. And doesn't that make a difference? Some of you know that it does. It makes all the difference in the world if you're caught up in the history of Jesus the Messiah and you have a share in his resurrection and a share in his empty tomb. We see contrasts with that hope all of the time. One of the ways in which pagans profess their faith, because even pagans profess their faith, one of the ways they do that is with these stickers that you see that people sometimes put on their cars or on their home windows or the front door or whatever. Sometimes there's a plaque on the wall. Generally, people in our culture don't easily and freely talk about the things that matter to them, but they will display their thoughts on a sticker, on a car window or a plaque in the home. And though some of these are intended as jokes, as you know, these little fridge magnets and what have you, behind the humour there is a certain world view or a belief, and they're telling you what they really think. And just a while ago I saw one with this phrase, "Life's a bitch and then you die." Well, doesn't that tell you something about the way that person looks at life, their world view? Would you display a statement like that if you didn't actually believe it? Doesn't that tell you something about the kind of hope that that person has or doesn't have? But contrast that with the hope of a young lady who died just a few weeks before her 18th birthday in 1748. Her name was Jerusha Edwards, the daughter of Jonathan and Sarah Edwards. She was a Christian. They didn't have stickers then. But they would put slogans on their gravestones. And on the gravestone of Jerusha Edwards, they put the words of Psalm 17, verse 15, "I shall be satisfied when I awake with thy likeness." Doesn't that tell you something about where her hope lay? Do you see the difference then that hope makes in life? It makes a difference when you know that you have a Savior who has written a different history that ends with an empty tomb. And Matthew is pressing that on us here. He wants us to see that there is a new story that doesn't end with the words, "And he died." And your history can be caught up into this new history, so that your story too will not end with the phrase, "And he died," or "And she died," but it will end in resurrection life. Hope. Hope. And then not only does he want to stir up this hope, but Matthew gives you this family tree to assure you of God's determination, the fact that God is determined. We might even say stubborn. I know you're not likely to recognize every name that we've read in this genealogy this morning, but if you look at verses 2 to 16 as a whole, you see that it divides into three groupings. Verses 2 through 6, verse 6 through 11, and then verse 12 to 16. And each group is describing a distinct section in Israel's history. It begins with Abraham and runs through to David. That's when Israel was a fragile people. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, then the 12 tribes, then slavery in Egypt and 40 years in the wilderness, wandering and then entering into the promised land and being oppressed by enemy nations. Through all that time, it was a very fragile people. But eventually you come to David, the king, and the golden age of Israel's history. But it was short-lived, and it only lasted till the first part of Solomon's reign. So that from verse 6, the rest of the list is a downward slide of the kingdom of Judah, and Israel becomes increasingly a faithless people through that period. And mixed in that list, you'll find some godly kings like Hezekiah and Josiah, but they also have kings like Ahab and Manasseh. And God has to bring judgment on Israel, a faithless people. And so they're taken into captivity in Babylon. And then in verses 12 to 16, you have a faltering people in exile. Even after they come back from the land of exile to Judah, always they're under foreign domination. If it's not the Babylonians, it's the Persians. And if it's not the Persians, it's the Assyrians. And if it's not the Assyrians, it's the Romans. But one after another, they come. So the history of Israel is outlined for us in this short genealogy, a fragile, faithless, faltering people. And yet God still brings his Messiah. He still brings this king who will establish his kingdom. But he doesn't do that because his people are so successful and so outstanding a people. On the contrary, for most of the time, they've been a faithless people and a weak and a fragile people. But in spite of that, and in spite of their sinfulness and their weakness, still God brings this one through whom the whole world will be blessed. So do you see how determined God is through it all to accomplish his purpose in the world? He will bring his king, and his plan is going to reach the climax in verse 16. And if it can't be done through his people's faithfulness, he will do it in spite of their unfaithfulness and their weakness. And notice the precise period there in which in his determination God brings the one through whom his people would be blessed, the precise time when he brings Messiah. It's in that section in verses 12 to 16 after the captivity of Babylon. It wasn't a very promising time for anything. What good could be achieved at a time like this amongst the people of God? Can you imagine when you get to the end of verse 11 and Judah is carried away into Babylon? Do you see how bleak the picture is? How bad things were? They had the promise made to Abraham of a land, and now that promise lies in total eclipse. They didn't even have the land. En masse, they've been carried away into Babylon. They used to have this promise made to David. They had a king. And now they don't even have a king. So both the promise made to Abraham and the problem made to David have been completely eclipsed. And it looks as though all the promises that God had made to his people had just gone down the drain. What good could they possibly expect now in these circumstances? It was a very dark time for Israel. On the 1st of April in 1948, 6 weeks before the end of the British Mandate in Palestine, a tramp steamer called the Nora arrived in the port of Haifa, and British customs officials at the port examined and then released the cargo, 600 tons of Italian onions. Not much there to be excited about, you might think, but the Israelis had been waiting for that ship with eager anticipation and excitement, because they knew that under the 600 tons of Italian tomatoes were 200 machine guns and 4,500 rifles and 5 million bullets, rounds of ammunition. So for the Israelis, underneath that very unpromising and uninteresting cargo, underneath it was a treasure. And here you're looking at a very bleak, unpromising, dismal scene for the people of God. What good could come out of this catastrophe, the exile in Babylon? Verses 12 to 16 are referring to a period there of about 500 years. What was it like when Azor begot Zadok, and Zadok begot Achim, and Achim begot Elihud, and Elihud begot Eleazar, and so on? What was it like during that period? Well, you read about it in the book of Nehemiah and the book of Haggai and Malachi, for instance. It was a dark and a dismal period for God's people when they just had to scrape out a meager sort of existence. And throughout that entire period, but for a very few years, they had to live under a foreign tyranny. Yet it's at that period, at that point in time, when things are at their bleakest and their darkest, it's at that point, when the sky was at the blackest for Israel, that the Sun of Righteousness arose and began to shine. Isn't it a strange time for Messiah to come then? And doesn't it underline for us this dogged determination of God? He promised this one who would bring blessing to his people, and strangely he brings him at the bleakest moment, when to all appearances all hope was gone. And yet that is a pattern that we see so often for God's people. It's clear that some of God's people were anticipating it. We're told in Luke 2 of Simeon and others with him who were waiting for the consolation of Israel. They knew it was a very dark situation, and they knew that in spite of that, Messiah must soon come. And they knew for two reasons. Firstly, because Herod was king. He was on the throne. And they knew because of God's word to Jacob, a prophetic word spoken as he was dying. Jacob said of the tribe of Judah, "The scepter shall not depart from Judah." That is, Judah would always be the ruling tribe. That's why when the tribes of Israel moved through the wilderness, Judah always took the lead. And that's why David was from the tribe of Judah, and that's why when the tribes were taken off into exile, the northern tribes disappeared, but the southern tribes, including Judah, were never destroyed, and they returned to the land. That's why even after they'd gone into Babylon, and after their return, it's the descendants of David in the tribe of Judah that exercised authority amongst the people. But now for a few years, nobody from the tribe of Judah has been ruling in Israel. Now it's Herod, an Idumean, and he's king. But 1,500 years earlier, Jacob had said, "The scepter shall not depart from Judah until, nor a lawgiver from between his feet until Shiloh comes." Shiloh was the place where the Israelites set up the tabernacle when they came first into Canaan. Shiloh was the place where God's presence was manifested. It was the dwelling place of God. And Shiloh became a name then for the one who is God among us. Jacob's prophecy was that Judah would be the dominant tribe until the time of the coming of Messiah. And those who knew the scriptures during the day of Herod the Great expected Messiah soon to come on the scene. At the very time when he appeared, it's when David's royal line, as it were, had been done away with and all but entirely extinguished. At that very time, stubbornly, determinedly, God brought Messiah onto the scene, his promised king. But doesn't that stubborn determination of God show itself in the lives of individual believers too? Isn't it true that sometimes in the darkest and the most hopeless moments of your life, when the sky has been the blackest for you, that it's been then that the Lord of hosts has brought relief to you, and you would never have guessed it was going to happen? And it's as if we could reverse the biblical text. Remember when Jacob wrestles with the angel of the Lord, "I will not let you go until you bless me." It's as if God says, "I will not let you go until I bless you." That's God's determination. And then Matthew speaks like this and writes this out for us in order to surprise us, to astonish us with God's grace. Did you notice in verses 3 to 6 something that ought to shine out like neon lights for us? He mentions four women: Tamar in verse 3, Rahab in verse 5, Ruth in verse 5, and the wife of Uriah in verse 6. Do you remember the stories of those ladies in the Old Testament scriptures? You might be a little rusty on Tamar. You read about her in Genesis 38. It's not a pleasant story. She was married to the oldest son of Judah, and Tamar's husband, and he died. So Judah's next oldest son married Tamar according to the law. He was responsible to raise up a family in his brother's stead and name, but he died too. Now, by rights under the law, Judah was obliged to have her marry his next son, his youngest son, Shelah. But he thought he was too young to be married, and so we read that he told Tamar to go and for a while live again with her father. And as you read the text in Genesis 38, you get the impression that Judah hoped, "You're never going to see this woman again." Well, the time came when Shelah was old enough to be married, and Judah's own wife had died, and Judah went with a friend to watch the sheep shearing at Timnah. And Tamar was told that Judah had come there. So she took her widow's clothing off, and she dressed instead as a prostitute, and she went and sat on the roadside and waited for Judah, her father-in-law, to come. And when he came, because he didn't recognize her because of the veil, he propositioned her. And she asked what he would pay. "I'll give you," he says, "a kid from my flock." "Well, how do I know you'll pay me? Have you got something you can give us collateral?" And so he gave to her as security for payment his signet ring and his staff. Now that would be like us giving a driver's license and a passport, something like that. And so the deal was struck and the deed was done, and off Judah goes. And later he sends a friend back with the young kid to get the staff back and his signet ring. But she's gone. And Judah assumes, "She's done me. There's nothing I can do. We don't know where this woman is." And 3 months later, Judah is told that his daughter-in-law Tamar is pregnant, that she's played the harlot. And Judah sees the opportunity and seizes it, and he says, "Bring her out here, let her be burned." And then she plays the trump card. She sends the staff and the signet ring to Judah, and she says, "These belong to the man who got me pregnant. Please determine whose they are. Judah ben Jacob." She gave birth to twins, Perez and Zerah, fathered by Judah, and there she is in the line of Jesus' descendants, Tamar. And then Rahab. We read of her in Joshua chapter 2. Rahab, the Canaanite prostitute. She welcomed the Jewish spies, Israel's spies, and confessed to them that she wanted the safety and the protection of their God when his judgment fell upon Jericho. So she sought mercy from the Lord, Israel's God, and she received it. She too is found in the ancestry of the Messiah. And then there's Ruth, whose story is told in the book that bears her name. She wasn't an Israelite, she was a Moabite. She didn't belong officially to the people of God. She came back to Israel with her mother-in-law, Naomi, And she was about the most hopeless person on earth, as you read the story. Ruth could have easily have abandoned her, as Orpah did. Naomi had lost practically everything. But Ruth travelled back with Naomi to Bethlehem, even though it looked like that would mean for both of them a life of grinding poverty. But Ruth saw the reality of the God upon whom Naomi had set her hope, and she took her mother-in-law's God to be her God. And then there's the wife of Uriah, verse 6. Notice Matthew doesn't call her Bathsheba. He calls her Mrs. Uriah. And you remember the story there in 2 Samuel 11 and 12, the trouble David fell into because he committed adultery with Bathsheba and all the foul deception that surrounded that incident. But you see what you have here. You've got four ladies. At least three of the four were not even Israelites. They were pagans. They were Gentiles. Three of the four were involved in sexual activity that is immoral, and yet they're in the family tree of Jesus the Messiah. What are you to make of that? How are you to understand that? You see, if you wanted to construct a history of the great women of the history of Israel, these are not the names that would immediately come to your mind, are they? If you were to ask a Jew, who are the mothers of Israel? Then they would answer, well, it's the wives of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah. They are the mothers of Israel. But Matthew doesn't include their names. Instead, he has Tamar, Rahab, Ruth, and the wife of Uriah. And you know the reputation that those women had. And so for Jews reading this passage, those names would have stood out as if Matthew had gone over them with a highlighter pen and then drawn a line around them with a biro or whatever. They are not people with good reputations. And what Matthew is doing then is pointing out huge examples of the amazing grace of God in the first page of the New Testament so that you don't miss it. Tamar, Rahab, Ruth, and Mrs. Uriah. And what this is telling us is that if you have this sort of person in the family tree of Jesus, then regardless of the sort of person I am and you are, we are being told that we too can be in the family of Jesus. If he has these people in his family tree, do you think he's too ashamed to have people like this in his congregation as well? Matthew is highlighting and underlining for us God's grace. But some of you don't believe that. Some of you may be saying to yourself, well, I can see the grace that Matthew is highlighting here and the sort of people that he includes in Jesus' ancestry, and that's great. But you see, in my life, there was that one sin that haunts my mind. Maybe it was 6 years ago, or was it 12, or was it 18? Maybe it was 30. You know what I'm talking about, don't you? And you think, I don't see how Jesus could accept someone like me. But wait a minute. Look at Bathsheba. And she's saying, did I hear someone say, there's one sin? I know what that's like. I know David usually gets all the blame, but I was the one who willingly consented to it. But somehow that didn't keep me out of the line of Messiah. And someone might say, oh yes, but if you knew my family background and the sort of connections I've got, if you knew my upbringing and the like, and how awful it all was, I'm just not from the right sort of family. But look at Ruth. Ruth could say, I'm a Moabite. I still am a Moabite. And according to Deuteronomy 23, the Moabites weren't ever to be allowed into the worshipping congregation of the Lord. But somehow, the Lord didn't think that that disqualified me from being an ancestor of Jesus. Someone else might say, but for me it's not a matter of birth and background and upbringing. If you only knew the kind of life I have lived by my own decision. Yes, but there's Rahab. And no matter what kind of stuff you have been or are involved with today, you probably wouldn't be able to tell her anything she hadn't seen herself, and most of it she will have done it herself. But she found mercy and she found a place amongst the people of God. So do you see what Matthew's saying to us as he includes these names? He's telling us that Jesus is not ashamed to be associated with sinners. He took enough criticism for that, you remember? Remember in Luke 7, the religious folk of his day criticized him for being a friend of sinners? And this explains what our church is. That the church is not a club, the church is a church. It's a place for sinners. It's a shelter for refugees seeking the grace of God. And if Jesus didn't flinch at the idea of being associated with Tamar and Rahab and Ruth and Mrs. Uriah, do you think he's going to blush to acknowledge you? Well, there are other reasons why Matthew begins his gospel with this genealogy, but that's enough for now. And we'll leave ourselves there for now in the arms of a gracious God. The Lord bless his word to us.